Hey there, weirdos, it's Herman, back again with another Patreon episode courtesy of Into the Weird, now released to the public, and this is our third Patreon show that we conceived of sometime around, I think, March of 2021, I'm not quite sure, but I got to thinking, the House of Ideas, Marvel, had so many licensed properties, Conan, of course, being one of them, which we do on Radio Free Arborea, but still, there must be another way we could turn this into a show. After all, I gotta find some way to talk ROM before I leave this life. So, ROM being one of my favorite comics as a kid, I kept trying to think of an angle, how to get him into the weird. Of course, we could have just have added him to the regular show, but I wanted to go issue by issue. Sadly, that doesn't look like it's gonna happen. But it might, who knows? I might resuscitate revive the Into the Weird at one point in time, maybe even this year, who knows. Still, I wanted to talk some ROM, and I wanted to talk Micronauts, some of my favorite series from when I was a kid, and I figured out a way to do that. So we created a House of Licensed Ideas, and this is the first episode of that. So if you want to let me know what you think, you can do so at the same old place, sinkintotheweird@gmail.com. And of course, I'll add any comments into this first introduction segment of every Patreon episode that we release. But right now, enough of this waffling. Let's get to the episode, House of Licensed Ideas, featuring, this time around, ROM, Space Knight, everybody's favorite kaiju, Godzilla, as he was interpreted by Marvel there in the 70s, and of course, the mighty Micronauts. So, here it is, House of Licensed Ideas, Episode 1.
Far, far away, in another galaxy, the Knights of the Soul Star Order, defenders of justice and truth, have been ambushed by the evil magicians, the Direites.
This is the world of the Micronauts, a Croyer, the enemy, and the Micronaut Space Warriors, all sold separately.
Discover Planet of the Apes.
The Shogun Warriors, Guy King with rocket boosters, Great Mazinga with rocket launcher.
Look, it's Godzilla!
Is he friend or foe? You can decide.
Wow.
Launch his claw. Imagine his breath is a blast of fire.
Into the Weird presents the House of Licensed Ideas, Episode 1. I'm your host, Herman Lowe, and with me, as ever, is my esteemed cohort, Billy Delicious. Welcome to the show, Billy.
Hey, Herman, how are you, brother?
Great, man. I can't complain, as per usual, especially when we're going to be talking comics. Life is good. So, Billy, House of Licensed Ideas, this is our first episode for our patrons on Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very new at this, but very excited to see how this will develop. And, you know, we picked some of our favorite titles to discuss this month, the month of May for the House of Licensed Ideas. Specifically, you and I are going to be talking about the first first issues of three licensed properties that Marvel, you know, had in the 1970s. And they are specifically one of our favorites, ROM, Space Knight. And then what's the second one, Billy? Also a good one.
Micronauts.
That's
so another good one. Yeah, based off a toy as well. So really good stuff.
Yeah, both written by Bill Mantlo. And then the third one is, we picked it because we're a fan of the character and of the movie franchise and just the general idea of this guy, and that's Godzilla. That's right. Marvel even licensed Godzilla, and he had his own series in the 70s. So we're going to be talking about those three licensed properties, listeners, and you know, both of them are a hell of a fun to read. I don't know if you would agree with me, Billy.
Oh yeah, for sure. No lies there. These were all fun to read. For different reasons, and we'll get into that as we go on here too.
definitely. So just to give the listeners a bit of a history of Marvel and their licensing of titles, this happened in the early 70s with Roy Thomas pitching licensed properties to Stan Lee, and they picked up the early ones such as Conan, obviously being the big one. Cull, it eventually became Cull as well, that from the Robert E. Howard staple that they got. And then the character Red Sonja flowed out of that, which was just mentioned by Robert E. Howard in an offhand story. You know, it wasn't really a character he put a lot of thought into, but Marvel really fleshed her out. And of course, you had then Planet of the Apes was a big one that they licensed, just not just for the comics, but also for the black and white magazines. You had 2001, A Space Odyssey from Stanley Kubrick that Jack Kirby famously penciled. Battlestar Galactica, which was a big deal even before Star Wars was a big deal. And then, of course, many people would remember this one fondly. For some people, even got them into comics, and that is G.I. Joe. We all love the toys, right, Billy? And the toys were amazing. They were a big part of my childhood and yours, I'm sure. And then the comics were just as good. It fueled your missions with the toys and, you know, during playtime by reading the comics. And then, of course, Transformers. We can't forget to mention that. That was one of Marvel's more popular licensed titles. You and I, we like the Transformers. I'm not saying I'm a super Transformer fan, but we definitely might cover it down the line. They had a unique Marvel perspective on the Transformers back then. They even licensed Masters of the Universe, but DC also had that license eventually. And then things like Silverhawks, the Inhumanoids, Thundercats, the Visionaries. They had Solomon Kane, another character from Robert E. Howard that was licensed by Marvel. And then even some musicians, you know, like the band Kiss had their own Marvel comics, Alice Cooper. Yeah, and then popular movie franchises like Star Wars, obviously being the big one, but also Indiana Jones. Marvel published lots of those comics. The Human Fly. Tarzan. Let's not forget The Lord of the Jungle, right, Billy? Doctor Who, even. Doctor Who, Tarzan. Oh, yeah. So Marvel licensed a hell of a lot of stuff. Even The Shadow, I think, at one point in time. Doc Savage made his way into Marvel comics. The Phantom, briefly. And then, of course, you know, Marvel licensed other things that could not really be considered licensed, but they published classic, you know, science fiction stories, such as H.G. Wells' stuff, you know, The Invisible Man, and stuff from Robert Louis Stevenson, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They even had a Willow graphic novel after the movie came out in the 80s. So my point is, there's a lot, and we're not going to work through all of them. We're just going to work through our favorites, specifically. Going forward, Billy, you and I were going to be talking about the first five issues over the course of the next 5 months, and that it would be the first five issues of ROM and the first five of Godzilla and the first five of Micronauts. And that's how we're going to go forward with House of Licensed Ideas. After those first five issues, we'll move on to John Carter, Warlord of Mars, one of our favorites too, Billy. You and I, we both love Edgar Rice Burroughs' creation, John Carter. And then we're also going to be doing Planet of the Apes. If we don't, some of our Twitter friends will vilify us and never speak to us again because they love their apes. You're one of them, Billy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so they're of the mind, and you, I know that apes make everything better. I agree with that.
Yep.
And then after that, you know, after doing Planet of the Apes, we might look at either Shogun Warriors, which was a toy line just like Micronauts and ROM that transitioned to Marvel Comics. And eventually down the line, we'll look at other things like Tarzan and Indiana Jones. So, Billy, first off, we're doing this a bit differently than Into the Weird, our regular show. We're going to be doing a synopsis. Both you and I are going to give our own spin on each issue's storyline, but we're going to do it Twitter style. No more than 280 characters. Maybe a little bit more is fine, you know, if you go over. That's how I wrote my synopsis. I went to Twitter, pretended to write a post so that I could see the number of characters. And I did go a little bit over, you know, but like three or four characters over. Well, so what? You know, it doesn't matter. We're going to give a Twitter-style synopsis, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't go to Twitter and do that. I just tried to keep things as brief as possible just to be, you know, I think I'm pretty close. So, you know, like you said, a little over, a little under, whatever. We're all good here.
That's awesome, man. No. So the first one we're going to be discussing, Billy, is a childhood favorite of both yours and mine, ROM, the Space Knight. Now, I'm going to give a rundown on his history, and then I'm going to ask you how you first got to know this title. Basically, ROM was a toy co-created by Scott Dankman, Brian L. McCoy, and Richard Levy. And it was sold to Parker Brothers. But originally, Scott Dankman envisioned ROM to be an Egyptian mystic. So he wasn't a cyborg. He wasn't a space hero at all. And of course, the idea, he peddled the idea around. It didn't work. So eventually, he decided, okay, let's make him a type of cyborg robot-like figure. And he called him COBOL. C-O-B-O-L, COBOL. Based on a computer term, an acronym that's computer-based. And then eventually that idea did sell to Parker Brothers, but Parker Brothers still didn't like the overall concept and the name specifically. So Parker Brothers were the ones who changed it to ROM. And that stands, of course, for read-only memory, right, Billy? So it's still a computer term that they thought. But it's a catchy name, you have to admit. So, you know, this was the very first toy, and I think the last toy that Parker Brothers ever produced. I mean, they're a board game company. That's what they're known for. So after that, you know, because ROM did so abysmally, it didn't sell well. I think 300,000 units of it sold, but because of a bad marketing campaign, they botched the advertising of ROM. It didn't actually produce any further toys. So the kids only had, you know, ROM, and it was suggested that they play with ROM, you know, along with other toys from other companies, which is never a good idea, right? Like the Combat Joe toys or something. So, but ROM was a pretty interesting toy, right, Billy? Now it's a collector's item, of course. It had some articulation, you know, twin red LED lights for eyes. And then, you know, it's got the silver sheen just like it does have in the comics. Looks very, you know, clunky, though, compared to the sleek Sal Buscema art, which we would get in the Marvel comic after they licensed it.
Oh, yeah.
So the toy did badly. But, you know, at the time, everybody was asking Marvel to promote their toys and their products and their films through licensed comics. And Star Wars famously did that in 1977, even before A New Hope was released. George Lucas approached Marvel. And the first two comics of Star Wars, right, Billy, were actually published before the movie came out. That's why, you know, when you read the old Marvel Star Wars, it almost doesn't make any sense, you know, because they were given, you know, a rough story plot, you know, Marvel, and so they did not actually, you know, accurately represent the Star Wars we got on film. But it's still, you know, it's a time capsule for us. It's a piece to own. So, you know, ROM, though, it became a highly successful comic, even though the toy flopped. And, you know, it ran for 75 issues, right, Billy, and four annuals, and you have all of that. I have all of that, you know. That was one of the very first Marvel series I tried to fill up because I loved it so much as a kid. And Billy, you know, then it ran from 1979 to 1986. And I want to ask you about the comic book series itself. Like, can you remember way back when you were a kid, like, how did you first encounter ROM? It definitely wasn't through the toy, was it?
No, not at all. I honestly cannot remember ever seeing the toy in a toy store or the commercials on television. Nothing at all. I never even heard of it until I started buying comics, you know, quite a few years later after the series even started. And I remember seeing the issue, the first issue, number one, and thinking, wow, this is great. This is cool. You know, picking it up and kind of sifting through it a bit, which, you know, you're really not supposed to do at a comic book store, but, you know, some of them are very lax about what they let you do. So I opened it up and checked it out, and I was like, this is crazy good. And from then on, I just started buying it every time I saw it, you know, as long as it was affordable. And of course, you know, back issues back then were affordable. They were like, you know, $1, $1.50 at the most. So I snapped them up like crazy. And up until maybe about 5 years ago, I had all but five issues of the entire series. Like, I would grab it every time I saw it because I thought it was great. I loved reading it.
Yeah, you recently filled up the run and you posted it on social media, and I was very impressed. I think your copies are in way better condition than mine, because I've had mine since, well, most of them since the 80s, and I didn't bag and board stuff back in the 80s and the early 90s, you know, but I only started bagging and boarding, I think, in 1996. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my copies are in a bad state, but, you know, I read them often because ROM has never been collected. It probably will never be collected because Marvel owns half of the characters, of the ROM cast, and yet ROM is still owned by Parker Brothers, and they've licensed it out, of course, now to IDW. Which they've continued with the ROM series, even though I think it finished, it ended. It was from 2015 to 2018. I bought it. It wasn't the same as the Marvel comics, but some good parts. But it ended in 2018. So, you know, ROM is still out there. I think they even had a special edition toy made for some cons. But, you know, that's very hard to find now. Me, though, if I had to buy a toy, I would like to buy the original ROM toy, which I don't own, because I'm not really a toy collector. I have action figures and statues, Billy, much like you, but I'm not a collector in that sense that I go hunting for specific things that I need or want to complete.
Yeah.
But, you know, ROM, I would really like to have that toy, though, because, you know, he's such a part of our, you know, comic book reading childhood that I want something extra from him. So, Billy, in terms of, you know, how ROM came to Marvel, though, it's a bit of an interesting story, which I'm going to recount briefly here. You know, Al Milgrom, you know him, of course, as an artist and an editor, also a writer, of course. You know, he used to work in the early 70s. He was actually related to Martin Goodman, believe it or not, you know, the publisher of Marvel at the time. But, and though Martin Goodman was known for nepotism, this did not much help Al Milgrom. I guess he was a distant relative, you know, not really, you know, in Martin Goodman's high esteem. So he wanted to break into the comic book industry, but he couldn't get work at Marvel in the early 70s. So, of course, Milgrom went to work for DC. But eventually he transitioned, you know, to Marvel. And then, you know, they decided to, because they saw this toy coming out, you know, ROM, and, you know, it was in 1979. Star Wars had hit it big in 1977. Everything was about science fiction at the time. Micronauts was doing really well from 1977 onwards as well. Their Star Wars licensing property was paying off. So they decided to go with ROM. And Al Milgrom had a big hand in bringing this character to Marvel. He liked the look of it. And, of course, ROM didn't have much of a mythology other than it was a space knight. So Milgrom saw the potential for fleshing this out. And then he had to pick a creative team. And he ended up picking Bill Mantlo and Sal Buscema. Now, Bill Mantlo, one of the greatest Bronze Age writers of all, you know, he was known as a fill-in writer, you know, and a pinch hitter when you know, editors needed a writer to do a story if you know, the regular writer on a title couldn't. So he filled in for a lot of tales, like Marvel 2-in-1, you know, Marvel Team-Up. The Incredible Hulk, of course, he had a famous run on, but, you know, he was a great fill-in writer because he was quick and always on time. And then he really showed his chops on ROM. He did it with Micronauts as well, which we'll talk about later, which came before ROM. But I think with ROM, he delivered his best work. 75 issues, all written by Bill Mantlo. And of course, the art is by a legend, and that's Sal Buscema. Now, Billy, I want to talk to you about this creative team. What do you think about Bill and Sal?
I love the bulk. I mean, Sal Buscema to me is a guy he doesn't get mentioned with the greats of the industry, the all-time greats of the industry. And I'm sure there's certain reasons for that. I think he's, you know, right underneath that group of greats. Like there's, you know, your top 5 or 10 or whatever, your Mount Rushmore. To me, he's right below those guys. A fantastic artist. And Bill Mantlo, if he didn't do like Micronauts and ROM, I'm not sure if he would have as big a following as he does, but the work he did on those two books, and you know, you can even go into it, like basically when Marvel got the rights to do ROM specifically, all there was a toy. So everything else, literally everything else you read in these comic books other than just ROM himself, was from the mind of Bill Mantlo. He created all of it.
Yeah.
So he is extraordinary writer. You just, like I said, Micronauts and ROM, are definitely his two shining stars. He did plenty of other good work too, but those two things really are what elevate him to not just, you know, an okay guy, but a really good writer for Marvel.
Yeah, a legend in his own right. Mm-hmm. We all know what happened to Bill, sadly, in the 1990s. After he left comic book writing, mm-hmm. I think he became a lawyer, and he was injured in a car accident. And then I think he was walking on the side of the road, right, Billy? It was a pedestrian.
I think he was rollerblading.
Oh yeah, he was rollerblading. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. So,
and somebody hit him and took off, and they still don't know to this day. I don't think who hit him. It's disgusting. It's horrible.
That's right. And he suffered some brain damage, and he's been bedridden ever since. And mm-hmm. you know, his brother's taking care of him, but financially is hard. You know, so but you know, it's a sad story for Bill, who gave us so much, yeah. Right, Billy? But you know, mm-hmm. Speaking about like what you said, yes, Bill was an amazing writer. We also do have to credit someone though, Billy. Jim Shooter, he had a big hand in mm-hmm. editing ROM. And you know, Jim, not a well loved character in, you know, comics, but he was a good editor, I would say. I mean, in the beginning at least, mm-hmm. and he shepherded ROM along. I think it was also Jim Shooter and. You know, at the time it was Jim Galton, I think, who was the comics president at Marvel, that, you know, went to Parker Brothers to do the actual licensing deal, you know, after mm-hmm. they decided on licensing ROM, and then they got a good deal for it. So, you know, a lot has to be said for the genesis of how they got to, you know, how they got ROM over to Marvel, and that's all about, you know, Jim Shooter. But Al Milgrom had a big hand in it, and of course the writing team of Sal Buscema and Bill Mantlo and Sal Buscema on the art. They were the main reasons why the comic did so well, because Sal is a fantastic artist. He can do anything, right, Billy? Much like his brother John Buscema, uh-huh. Sal did the Hulk for a very long time, and that was one of my favorite runs of The Incredible Hulk. And then, you know, he did the Defenders, which you and I both love. So you can't go wrong. Just give us some Sal Buscema art and we'll, you know, drool all over it. That's basically what we're like. So, but to get to the comic book itself now, because we've still got two others to discuss, let's tackle ROM's storyline here. The first mm-hmm. issue, we're going to do the Twitter-style synopsis. I'm going to let you go first. What was your brief Twitter synopsis for ROM number one?
Okay, so ROM, Space Knight, has arrived on Earth and has been scouring the cosmos in search of the evil dire wraiths. They've been on Earth for decades now and blended in with the populace, and it's up to ROM, Space Knight, to weed them out and destroy them.
Excellent. Dude, you see, it's totally, yes, that's what I love. It's totally different than my synopsis, but, and yet, you know, mm-hmm. you get some extra information when you do both. Okay, here's mine. Mm-hmm. An asteroid crashes on Earth, and from it emerges the greatest of the space knights, ROM. Hunting the evil dire wraiths, Galador's finest wrecks the car of young Brandy Clark, invades her hometown of Clairton, vaporizes some wraiths, moiters the National Guard. Notice I said moiters, not murders. He doesn't really murder any of them. And then he kills some more wraiths. That's basically mm-hmm. the rough synopsis of issue one, right?
Yeah.
So fun. Now, the cover, Billy, of issue number one was done by Frank Miller and inked by mm-hmm. Joseph Rubinstein. Now, Frank was already hot at this mm-hmm. time in 1979. He was the young up-and-comer. This is a brilliant cover. I love it. It's so iconic. What do you think, Billy? Mm-hmm.
And oh, yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, man, it's amazing. We're going to discuss, you know, that at the end of all three issues. We're going to pick our favorite covers, favorite bits of dialogue, and favorite, panels. Mm-hmm. But this cover, it's hard to beat. And then it was first published, of course, in December 1979. At least that's the cover date. The on-sale date was September the 4th, 1979. And it was only 40 mm-hmm. cents. Page count 32, edited, actually, in this case, by Mary Jo Duffy, not by Jim Shooter. And the title of the first story is called Arrival. Very appropriate, right, Billy? And then written by Bill Mantlo, of course, art by Sal Buscema, and lettered by Tom Orakowski and colored by Bob Sharon. So, Billy, let's mm-hmm. talk about this issue, man. Lots of great moments. I'm going to let you go first. What do you think about that first page of the comic?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I mean, this is, like you said, 1979, 1980, the science fiction craze was in full swing with, you know, Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica, Star Trek, I think. Didn't that movie come out around this time?
Yeah, it did.
The first motion picture?
Star Trek, yeah. It did.
Yeah, so people were going berserk for science fiction right now. Television, movies, everything. And you open the first page and you see, you know, this robot from space, you know, busting out of this, you know, asteroid, and Arrival. And it's incredible. Sal Buscema, awesome. All the caption boxes by Mantlow are great. They really get you on the edge of your seat. And colors, you know, like you said, Bob Sharon, very good too with the colors in here. And obviously it's like, you know, right away he meets a human and she's scared, doesn't know what the heck's going on. And he actually, maybe you want to go into this, how he has these two almost weapons that he uses to figure out who's a Wraith and who's a human.
That's right. Yeah, this is directly from the toy line, of course. They marketed Rom with three devices, two weapons and one universal translator to allow him to obviously understand the alien languages spoken on the planets he travels to. And we'll get into Rom's origin just now as told in issue one, but he has, well, the main device that I think he has is his neutralizer. The neutralizer is his weapon, but first off, he has to use the analyzer. The analyzer is the device that he uses to detect his enemies, the Dire Wraiths. After all, Billy, they're shape changers, much like the Skrulls. Their MO is to infiltrate planets that they happen upon. They're fleeing the Space Knights, basically. They're fleeing specifically Rom, who's hunting them across the galaxy after defeating them in a massive battle. And when Rom finds a planet that he knows has Dire Wraith activity, he lands and then starts to, you know, scan the population with his analyzer. And then when he sees their Dire Wraiths, he neutralizes them with his neutralizer, which could, it seems to, I mean, it has two settings, right, Billy? Basically, it has a kill setting, which just disintegrates whoever it blasts. But then it also has a setting where it banishes the, you know, the attacker or the target to limbo. And that's what he does frequently to the Dire Wraiths, because it's literally like throwing them into the pits of hell, which is... and sometimes it still looks like he disintegrates them, but apparently when they're banished to limbo, they leave some type of residue behind, which seems to that the Rom actually disintegrated them. But you know, they're later on in the comic, there was a time where when he tweaked the settings of the neutralizer to kill mode, and then, you know, basically he just blasts everybody. So the neutralizer, very powerful weapon. He normally recalls his weapons from subspace, which is this infinite storage space that he uses. And he's able to, with futuristic technology from his planet Galador, to call his weapons forth whenever he needs them. And in this very first issue, he uses all three, right, Billy? He uses the analyzer to scan the population of the small town Clareton, where he's happened upon. And also, of course, he scans Brandy Clark the very first time he appears in front of her, and she crashes her car, and then he ends up saving her by, you know, preventing her car from falling off a cliff or rolling down a hill. He scans her, and you've got this great Sal Buscema panel of Brandy fearing for her life, because she's thinking this is an alien robot. She's seen the 1950s sci-fi movies, right? Alien robots arrive, they're gonna blast you. No, this is just scanning her. Now, Billy, I want you to talk about these weapons of Rom. Like, they're very innovative. They look almost like these high-powered flashlights or something, actually, you know, or like, you know, the strobe lights or something, but, you know, angular, very square like in appearance. But I've always loved them. I've loved the blast, which is, it's almost like he's cut off the head of the X-Men Cyclops, the X-Men leader Cyclops, and he's like using it as Perseus used the head of Medusa or something to blast things, because it very much looks like an optic beam that streams forth from this red, you know, aperture from his neutralizer and his analyzer as well. So, Billy, what do you think about those weapons? Pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah, I love it. And it's, you know, it's fun because it's like twofold here. So you have a robot showing up with these, you know, laser guns or whatever you want to call them. So obviously, like you said, the populace doesn't know he's there to weed out these aliens. So they just, like, run and scream in terror. And there's a group of people that he turns the analyzer on, and they say, "Look out, he's turning it on us. It must be a death ray."
Yeah.
Save us. And then the two seedy looking characters in the back of the group of people who actually are wraiths are like, "Oh crap, he's gonna get us." And he does find them and then just absolutely blast them with the neutralizer.
That's exactly what happens. He leaves Brandy to wonder at the fact that she's still alive, to marvel at that fact, you know, after being scanned by the analyzer, and then immediately heads into town and blasts these two wraiths who were basically half of the town has been infiltrated by the dire wraiths. But yeah, there's even some of them in government, because later when they see that Rom appears in the town, what do, Billy?
Oh, yeah. Well, they call the National Guard. Well, actually, the mayor tries to get help, who is not a wraith. And Bill Mantlo's having some fun here. So he's kind of poking a little fun at people that live in West Virginia. No offense to our listeners from West Virginia. But he's kind of poking a little fun at, you know, their kind of, I'm trying to think of a politically correct way to put this, but like how it's like West Virginia is very like small town USA. There's not a lot of big cities there. It's a very small state. They're very outdoorsy. So he's trying to poke fun at them. So when the mayor tries to call to get help, I guess the person on the other end of the line says, "Have you been drinking?" And he says, "I haven't been drinking," when they say there's a big robot terrorizing the town.
Oh man, that's horrible, Billy. No, because I'm not from the state, so I didn't catch that. It's good that you mentioned that, but that is mean.
Yeah.
But nice one, Bill, you know. Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I do like about Bill Mantlo here is also he, you know, took the he clearly loved watching the, I think his brother also mentioned this in an interview, you know, recently, that he and Bill, they never talked comics much, but they loved watching 1950s sci-fi movies. And there's a lot of that in Rom, like this arrival, you know, very the day the earth stood still kind of feeling, right, Billy? So,
oh yeah.
Yeah, man, Bill, you know, a fan of the pop culture of the 50s and the 60s in which he grew up, he's obviously poured all of that into Rom here, and it worked. Now, Billy, it's mentioned Rom's look is very distinctive, but, you know, Rom's one of the more indestructible characters in Marvel. You know, if you think about it, he's arguably much more powerful than Iron Man. For reasons being that he's more lethal, he's way stronger. I mean, he seemed to have held his own against the Hulk briefly, right, Billy? Now, Iron Man could do that too, you know, in the Silver Age, but, you know, later on, no. And, of course, the main reason why Rom is so powerful in comparison to someone like Iron Man is because his Galadorian body, his cyborg body, which is not just his armor, but let's call it armor. I mean, he's a fusion of human and cyborg technology, right? So he's like Cyborg from the Teen Titans, except more complete. I'd say, what, like 99% almost, or 90% cyborg. His armor is composed of the metal plandanium, which is almost as indestructible as adamantium. So, but it has been shown to, in fact, be damaged. But adamantium has been damaged too, right, Billy, in comics. So, but the armor also has self-repair capabilities. You know, so that's so much like the Vision, the android from Marvel that we like, that can actually also heal over time. Rom can do that too. His armor can actually do that. But the more severe the damage, the longer it takes to repair, obviously. And then Billy's got these two backpack rockets, which are so powerful and generate such an amount of thrust that it propels him through space, through vast distances of space. So I don't know what he uses for a power source, but it's near infinite. I mean, if theoretically he has access to subspace, he could also have access to a subspace power source, like a miniature sun or something. But he never runs out of power, per se. And of course, he can survive in the vacuum of space. And he's incredibly strong. He throws tanks around like they're bathtub toys, right, in this issue. And he can withstand multiple blasts from, you know, tank cannons without even, you know, being staggered. So, you know, Rom's an incredibly powerful character. This is established right off the get-go here, because he takes on the National Guard and routs them. Right, Billy?
Yeah.
And then he ends up blasting more wraiths at the end, but not before first kidnapping Brandy in order to get the, you know, origin story that, you know, the listener, that the readers so much, you know, need so badly in the first issue, mm-hmm. right? So, Billy, you want to talk about Rom's origin briefly. What is the main concept here with Rom, the Galadorians versus the Dire Wraiths?
Right. So you see, they go into a pretty in-depth, you know, origin for him here, like in the middle of the story. Like they have, like, I don't know, maybe 5 pages of, you know, this intro we've been talking about. Then right smack in the middle of the issue, they have his origin, and then they finish off with more, you know, in the now. But yeah, it shows, you know, the Galadorians, you know, going across the galaxy to just try to, like, help out other planets. Like, they're very benevolent. They're just going to planets that don't have, you know, technology like they do to, you know, make their lives better, and they're helping these planets out. But in the meantime, you have the, you know, evil Dire Wraiths that are the exact opposite. They just want to go around and terrorize people and stuff like that. So this giant armada of Galadorians gets attacked and just slaughtered by the Dire Wraiths, and word gets back to the home planet of Galadorian. The Dire Wraiths kill them, and they're coming to their home. So then they realize they need to initiate, you know, a project of taking voluntary citizens and making them into these cyborgs to defend the planet, and then not only defend the planet, go out into the rest of the universe to hunt down the Dire Wraiths and, you know, either blast them into oblivion or send them to limbo.
Exactly. Yeah, I find this story amazing. It's got shades mm-hmm. of, you know, if you think Rom is a space knight, this is very Arthurian, you know, King Arthur-like storytelling here, mm-hmm. right, Billy? Because you've got these mm-hmm. knights who are drafted, and they only pick the best of the best, the bravest and the most physically capable of the Galadorians, even though millions volunteered. I think that only happened on 1,000 or a couple of thousand Galadorians. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Billy, the Galadorians have incredible scientific resources at their command, but their problem was, like you said, they were too benevolent. They were victims of their own hubris. And when they approached this dark nebula, trying to spread the light of their, you know, philosophy of goodwill, they encountered these Dire Wraiths. Now, the Dire Wraiths seems to have two weapons at their disposal. Also, their own brand of weird science and sorcery. I mean, one of the Dire Wraiths' commanders is a sorcerer who calls up from this little globe, which could be like, you know, a fortune teller's globe or whatever, but it's definitely a control panel or something of some sort, a magical panel. He calls up this creature called a Deathwing, and that is a horrific panel. When they first destroy the Galadorian fleet, you see all of these Galadorians decaying and becoming these wraiths themselves, right, Billy? Almost. Mm-hmm. But they're dead. They're drifting through space. Their bodies are you know, becoming corpses, you know, floating through space mm-hmm. just because of this Deathwing that soared through them. And then, now, this is a very modest retelling of his origin, because Billy, Rom never refers to himself, even though it's apparent through, you know, the panels we're shown that Rom mm-hmm. is the hero of the story already. But he doesn't tell Brandy that. He just says the, you know, the bravest of the brave volunteered. And then he's the first one to volunteer to undergo mm-hmm. the cyborg, you know, fusion, the process that turns them into these superhuman cyborgs. And then right. after he volunteers, millions further volunteer. So he was the bravest of the brave, but he doesn't mention that. And then he's also the hero in the final battle that destroyed the Deathwing, you know, that evil mm-hmm. Creature that they the Wraiths had at their disposal. And he's also the one who volunteered to hunt them down, the rest of the race, who have now scattered through space because their home Dark Nebula has in fact been invaded by the Galadorians successfully, but now they're still, you know, a threat to the rest of the galaxy. So, you know, mm-hmm. I love this origin story. Great. You know, even Galador, if you think about it, it's a very King Arthur Arthurian type of name, you know, Galahad, Galador. You know, mm-hmm. so we've got great action scenes. Rom, like I say, throwing tanks around, he punches a tank at one point in time, right, Billy? Crom.
Right.
When the National Guard shows up, flamethrowers don't faze him. In fact, he says he's flown near suns, so this is not going to bother him at all. And, you know, when he first arrives at the town, we've got this great special effect, you know, oh, sorry, this great sound effect where he blasts these two wraiths. Shriet! And we'll see that sound effect again many times. And, you know, then, you know, he beats up the National Guard. He kills some more wraiths. And that's basically the end of the story. But great action panels throughout. And it just ends with Brandy, you know, believing him. She finally saw with her own eyes that these wraiths are, in fact, people she's known most of her life, because they attacked her at the very end there, right, Billy? By grabbing her and grabbing, brandishing a weapon that could hurt Rom, unlike the human weapons employed against him. So Brandy was a witness to this. She tried to save Rom. She did, in fact, save him, and she grabbed the weapon, but the dire wraiths accosted her, and then Rom, kind of, you know, spaghetti western style, just took them out with one zap. He fried the three wraiths, and one of them escaped, vowing that they'll go to other towns to ensure Rom's demise with whatever means they have at their disposal. So Billy, that's the end of the first Rom issue. Next month, it says there's another story by Love Betrayed. Now, listeners, if you're not familiar with Rom, keep an eye on this character, Brandy Clark. She will be a major player in the Rom series. In fact, she's arguably the second most important character in the Rom mythology. Would you agree with that?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Billy, that was a fantastic issue. It's going to be hard to beat this one, but we'll head off into our next one, which is Godzilla. Now, Billy, okay, recently Godzilla's been in the news. You know, there's been the Godzilla vs. Kong movie. I've seen it. I've streamed it. It's good, but, you know, I'm not much for that kind of movies. But I did love Godzilla growing up as a kid, you know, seeing the old Toho films, rented it on VHS. I like the idea of Godzilla, you know, this... obviously, this monster called a kaiju. And, you know, I don't know how you feel about the comics. Have you read many Godzilla comics, Boo, other than the Marvel comics?
No. I mean, I did grab a few of the IDW comics when they got the license, because I think I was just in the store at the time and started to buy a little bit more non-Big Two comics. You know, I was buying more Dark Horse and IDW at the time. And I like Godzilla, so I was like, oh, wow, new Godzilla comic. So I grabbed number one and a couple issues afterwards. And they were cool. You know, I didn't love them, but I didn't hate them either. They were cool. I liked them. Like, oh, okay, cool. But I eventually was like, eh, I'm good. But the Marvel ones, I only have maybe one or two of the singles, but I grabbed the Essential when I was at a show, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. I don't know, whenever it came out. I think it was that long after it came out, but I grabbed the Essential at a show. And read it that way, and it's fun. It's not, you know, anything earth-shattering or you know, anything that's like high art, but it's just fun. It's a fun, goofy comic.
Yeah, man, it's more aimed towards kids, I think, mentioned in many interviews by writer Doug Munch. And of course, we've got the great Hulk artist Herb Trimpe as his partner doing the art, Doug Munch writing. And we, you know, we're both big fans of Munch. I'm a fan of Trimpe's Hulk at times. You know, sometimes I'm not feeling it. But Herb Trimpe is a great go-to artist in Marvel. You know, he's solid. You know, his stuff is visually pleasing. I'd say that he's one of the stalwarts, if not my favorite. But, you know, it worked for Godzilla. They made a great team here. And the funny thing is, this is not like the Toho Godzilla, the Godzilla that the Japanese crowds were used to. They tweaked him a little bit to make him more palatable, mm-hmm. well, in their words, for kids. But, you know, Billy, I think the concept is great. Any kid would glom onto this. Kids love dinosaurs. You know, Godzilla is not a dinosaur. He's a prehistoric lizard who was, you know, awakened by, you know, human nuclear testing, and then obviously empowered somehow by this nuclear radiation, which he absorbed, giving him this nuclear breath. And he's also gigantic inside. There's never been a creature as big as Godzilla, I'd say. He dwarfs most skyscrapers, he terrorized Japan, and he shows up on the Alaskan coast in the very first issue here. But, you know, a little bit more about the history. You know, obviously Marvel was licensing things all over the place, and, you know, Godzilla was very popular in the 70s, you know, especially among kids. And so, you know, Marvel had the idea to license Godzilla as well, and then they easily got the license from Toho, and then they asked Doug Munch to helm it, and eventually they got Herb Trimpe aboard. So they had an interesting approach to Godzilla, because they decided, hey, let's integrate him into the Marvel Universe. That's why, but we're not going to have him fight the Hulk or anything like that. No. We want one specific part of the Marvel Universe, which would seem ideal to actually tackle this giant monster invasion, which is, of course, who are they, Billy?
Shield.
Specifically, Dum Dum Dugan. Who's, you know, helming the helicarrier, one of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s, you know, premier weapons at the time. And Nick Fury makes appearances every now and then, too. So it's basically Dum Dum Dugan versus Godzilla. And the vast resources of S.H.I.E.L.D., which seems to avail them naught in the beginning, because Godzilla shows up, he crushes a lighthouse, and then he attacks an oil pipeline and destroys it. He whips it around like a jump rope. S.H.I.E.L.D. shows up with their crack troops and weapons. They even have an experimental laser cannon. They blast away. Nothing hurts Godzilla. Basically, he's like ROM, right? This is like the National Guard versus ROM. Same result, same outcome. Godzilla totals them all. But it seems that Nick Fury, being definitely smarter than Dum Dum, don't get me wrong, I love Dum Dum Dugan. You know, he's a great character. I one of my favorite Howling Commandos, along with Nick Fury. But Fury's the smart one, right, Billy? He comes, he has gotten a team together, specifically three Japanese nationals who have dealt with Godzilla before, who have a secret weapon. Now, Billy, before we get into the details of the story, can you give us your Twitter synopsis here for the first issue of Marvel's Godzilla?
No problem. Okay, so an unusually warm springtime melts a gigantic block of ice in Alaska. What emerges is the giant fire-breathing menace Godzilla. Will S.H.I.E.L.D. be able to stop this incredible monster? Not likely.
Excellent. Oh, that's better than mine. Okay, mine rehashes what I just said, you know, before your synopsis. Okay, here it goes. Godzilla makes landfall in Alaska, stomps on a lighthouse, tears up an oil pipeline. A S.H.I.E.L.D. helicarrier helped by Dum Dum Dugan engages, but they get a royal kicking from everyone's favorite kaiju. In the aftermath, Fury shows up with a Japanese entourage and a secret weapon known only as the Valise. So, you know, that's it. Basically, the weapon at the end is something Dum Dum Dugan didn't expect. The Japanese just hand him this little briefcase with apparently plans for, you know, a strategy for engaging Godzilla. So, Billy, just a little bit more about the character. Of course, Godzilla first appeared in 1954 in the film Godzilla, and, you know, produced by Toho Studios in Japan. And they produced 32 films specifically, and there was 4 Hollywood films, of course, a massive amount of video games and comic books and even TV shows. And of course, the Marvel title specifically bears the name King of the Monsters, right, Billy? So this Marvel comic known as Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And, you know, it was the cover art is great. It's Herb Trimpe. And then you've got, you know, the writer being Doug Munch. penciled the interior is done by Trimpy as well. Inker Jim Mooney, you know, which we both love. We love Mooney's stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Joseph Rosen as the letterer, and colors by Janice Cohen. And it was first published, cover dated August 1977, on sale May the 3rd, 1977. Just 30 cents, 32 pages, edited by Archie Goodwin, one of our favorite Marvel editors. So, yeah, well, Archie's the man for editing monster stuff, right, Billy?
Yeah, I can only imagine what he thought of this.
Just another day at the Marvel bullpen offices. That's another crazy title coming his way. So, you know, I enjoyed this first issue for what it is, right, Billy? He doesn't look like the classic Godzilla at all. You know, he looks more dinosaur-like. Mm-hmm. Or it's probably better to compare him to the Godzilla movie from, you know, starring, who was it? I forgot now. But, you know, in the late 1990s, they made a Godzilla movie.
Don't mention that. Yeah,
yeah, that was a horrible Godzilla movie. But yeah. But this Godzilla has a similar look because he's basically like a giant iguana, you know, terrorizing these folk. I like the classic look more, you know, where he's got a smaller head, giant legs, muscular arms, but not you know, like at all like an iguana, and black, you know, I like my Godzilla black. And you know, I like it when he has nuclear breath, not fire breath. Here it's firmly like a dragon. He's like a dragon the way Trimpy draws him, you know, he breathes fire, but very effective in, you know, lots of giving us lots of action panels, right, Billy, which I enjoyed. And I think kids at the time must have gone ape. This is not Planet of the Apes. They must have gone dinosaur over this.
Yeah, it's great. Trimpy did a great job, and Mooney with the inks too. Mooney is he's another unsung guy. You know, he's pencils, like, you know him too from the other side of the street with Supergirl. He did some great stuff with her back in the probably Silver Age, I would imagine.
And
then he inked even some really good issues of John Buscema's pencils for Spider-Man, like after, you know, the Ditko.
That's right.
And Romita eras, like, yeah, he's great. So this artwork looks fantastic. Like you say, Godzilla's a little, like, I wouldn't say off, but just a little different. But yeah, overall, the artwork is fantastic in this issue.
Yeah, I mean, the artwork is great, and Godzilla's also got his little bit of an origin story here. Not really an origin; it's more like, you know, just a brief recap of what we've seen from the movie. But his origin's been tweaked in film over the years. But basically, Billy, the premise is the same here. He is a giant prehistoric lizard who slumbered underneath, you know, the crust of the earth. And then he was awakened by man's activity, specifically nuclear testing, you know, in the ocean by Japan. And because of that, he absorbed the radiation. He empowered himself and awakened to deal with these puny little insect-like creatures who had disturbed his slumber, and he rampaged through Japan, and now he's rampaging through, you know, the States. So S.H.I.E.L.D. has to engage him. But, you know, I love the fact that, you know, we've got the setup where S.H.I.E.L.D. is going to employ all this technology that they have to bear, that they, most of them, obviously most of it's supplied by Tony Stark, but you know, S.H.I.E.L.D.'s right. got other surprises up their sleeve. So now it's basically this matter of containment and, you know, hunting down Godzilla, or, you know, it's kind of like the Hulk, the premise of the Hulk comic as well. How can the U.S. government, how can General Ross come up with new ways of, you know, curbing the menace of the Hulk? And this is exactly what Godzilla is. But so nothing new there, but, you know, great. I like the level of destruction. Basically every issue, the level of destruction ramps up. And we're going to get some wacky issues down the road, listeners. I mean, this is Into the Weird after all. There's even an issue later on, Billy, where they use Pym particles to shrink Godzilla, and then Dum Dum Dugan and Godzilla have a brawl, you know, like a fight, like the fight you'd expect from something like, you know, John Carpenter's They Live. It's like something like that. So, you know, we're going to get some great scenes and great Marvel moments. It's wackadoodle. So, Billy, that's Godzilla for us. Now, like I said, at the end, once we've discussed the final issue, we'll talk about what we liked and what's our favorite stuff. The cover is great. We're going to shelf that for now and talk about that again at the end. But let's head off to our final licensed property here. And what is that, Billy? Again, remind our listeners.
Micronauts, number one.
Biotron. Space Glider. Hydrocopter from the Micronaut Collection. Biotronet Hydrocopter need assembly. All have interchangeable parts. A few changes and Hydrocopter is a paddle boat or a one-man cruiser. You can combine it with Biotron and build your own toys. Like these. Batteries for Biotron and Hydrocopter not included. Hydrocopter, Biotron, and Space Glider, all sold separately by Mego.
Now, Billy, I've got probably a longer history with Micronauts than you, at least from our conversations off mic. This was one of the first, well, that box that my uncle gifted me, you know, when I was 4 years old in 1979, that got me into comics. This old long box he had, it had at least 300 comics in, more maybe. It had a hefty chunk of Micronauts. But then I also remember it was readily available on the shelves. And so even though I never filled up my Micronauts run, I still haven't filled it up. I actually had to borrow some comics from a friend in South Africa who does have the complete run. And he, by borrow, I mean he scanned it in for me, you know, the ones that I missed. So, but you know, I've always loved the series. And the reason why I haven't filled it up is because, you know, I want it in pristine condition. So I'm waiting for that holy grail of someone posting their entire Micronauts collection of a very fine or higher grade. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. But, you know, so Micronauts was a sci-fi comic, you know, very reminiscent of Star Wars, but it was actually not inspired by Star Wars at all. It was just inspired by the general sci-fi craze of the 1970s. And in 1977, toy companies were jumping on the bandwagon, of course. ROM came in 1979, which was also based directly off of the success of things like Micronauts and Star Wars as toys. But Micronauts, firmly a toy first. And it's got an interesting history, Billy, the Micronauts toy line. It started in Japan, actually, and then it transitioned to the States. You know, so the story goes like this. Basically, they are now primarily known as a North American science fiction toy line, you know, and specifically marketed by Mego from 1976 to 1980. But actually, it's based on a toy called Microman from the Japanese toy company Takara, and they created this in 1974. Now, Billy, the thing with that we have to compare Micronauts to in this, you know, episode is obviously ROM. ROM was a flop as a toy, but a huge success as a comic book. Star Wars, which we'll talk about down the line as we get to more episodes of House of Licensed Ideas, was a success on both fronts. Micronauts was, even before Star Wars, a success on both fronts. It was a success as a toy and a successful series for Marvel, fleshing out the mythology of the Micronauts. However, there's a bit of a, if you watch shows like Netflix's The Toys That Made Us, you know, where it discusses the stories behind the toys that so influenced us as kids, Billy, you'd see that the toy company Mego, or you pronounce it Mego, right?
Mego.
They passed on the opportunity to license the Star Wars toys, and it went to Kenner. And then Kenner made it big, and they eventually pushed the Micronaut line out of the market in 1982, and Mego went bust, right, Billy? But before the Star Wars toys hit it big, Micronauts was all the rage. In fact, it was everywhere. Kids were playing with it, apparently. I mean, I never even owned a Micronauts toy, right, Billy? It just wasn't a thing in South Africa where I grew up. And you weren't into that, right? Nope. I think we're more like 80s.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, we're more 80s toy people, right? But literally, yes, they disappeared off of the shelves after Star Wars made it big in the toy realm and, of course, in the movie realm as well. But, you know, for a while there, they were Mego's best-selling product. They accounted for more than 30% of Mego's profits. And, you know, they basically consisted of, I think, 3.5-inch tall action figures, much, much like you'd think G.I. Joe maybe would be. And they were known for, at the time, a high number of articulation points, Billy, which was not the standard for toys at that point in time. So they sort of, they were considered groundbreaking at the time. So kids loved it. And also it included vehicles like the G.I. Joes from the 1980s would, robots, playsets, alien creatures. And many of the parts could be connected you know, like Lego. It could be fleshed out. You could, you know, add some parts to your figure or to your vehicle to flesh it out. And this made them even more bucks, of course, for Amigo, because they kept selling these accessories. And then, you know, Billy, the Takara Toy Company in Japan, they did moderately well in 1974 with their Microman series. And it was based off of a 1972 toy called Henshin Cyborg, which was a transforming cyborg. So this is all before Transformers. And this is sort of what set the stage for stuff like G.I. Joe and Transformers, you know. And then eventually it moved over to the States, where Mego got it. And then they created this. They were very innovative at the time. We have to understand that. We have to give them their credit for this, right, Billy? Yeah. Because the concept of cyborgs, you know, half human, half robot figures, basically, it didn't come from this. Of course, it came from people like Isaac Asimov. But in the toy realm and popularizing this among kids, you could definitely credit Micronauts for this. And then, you know, Marvel obviously got the license as well. But this is a bit of a funny story. Marvel didn't approach them, or they didn't approach Marvel. I mean, after all, remember, George Lucas approached Marvel before Star Wars made it big in order to get some advertising by asking if they want to license this this movie property that's going to come out as a comic book. Now, this is not the way it happened. Apparently, again, writer Bill Mantlow, that we know on ROM, for 1977, his son had received a Micronauts playset. And Mantlow was so taken by these toys and the sheer sci-fi-nicity, if there is a word like that. Anyway, if there isn't, I'm owning it. I'm creating that word. The sheer sci-fi-ness of this playset. He was so inspired. He immediately went to Jim Shooter and he said, listen, we got to do this. We got to license these Micronauts as a property for Marvel. I have this whole universe that I can put them in. I can flesh them out, and we can make this amazing story. And that's what they did, right, Billy? They approached Mego. They got the license, and that's the rest is history. You know, so Jim Shooter approved it almost immediately after Mantlow gave him a bit of a rough draft of the series. Jim Shooter loved it. And you know, after that, they got Michael Golden, you know, fantastic artist, you know, fantastic cover artist and great with interiors. And, you know, later on in the series, they had such, you know, legendary artists as Ditko, right? Billy Ditko did a stretch. They also had, you know, Howard Chaykin, Val Myrick. We love Val Myrick from Man-Thing. Keith Giffen, you know, fresh off of his Defenders run. Greg LaRocque, Gil Kane, Luke McDonald. You know, they had lots. Pat Broderick, I think, was there. Rich Buckler. You know, great artists in their own right. And they were all on Micronauts at one point in time.
Yeah.
You know, so then Micronauts was a very successful Marvel comic. But the first issue, Billy, was all over the place. I think you'd agree. They were very, they were juggling too many balls, and they tried to, you know, put that all into a coherent whole. It sort of didn't really work. But later on, the series would hit its stride. That's kind of why I left Micronauts till last, even though it arguably came before ROM, you know, in 1977. So, Billy, let's head into the series and talk about Micronauts. you can go first again with your Twitter-style synopsis for Micronauts number one.
Okay. A long time ago in a microverse far, far away.
Brilliant.
The first chapter is Homeworld and shows us a ruling class getting annihilated by insurgents. Very few escape. Most do not live through the event. So there you go.
Well, that's true. That's basically what happens, right? It's an insurgency. And very apt comparing it to Star Wars. Though unfair, Billy, because it came before Star Wars, but whatever. Star Wars eclipsed it.
we'll get into it as we go on. It is definitely a totally separate thing, but you do get that vibe from this.
No, of course, of course. It's even got chapter one, you know, it's all of that. Yeah. So Billy, that's what I like about this when we both do a short synopsis of comics, because you and I approach it a bit differently. You focus on the larger events, I focus on the characters sometimes. So here, I've got some characters in here. Okay, here's mine. Caught in an uprising, the rulers of Homeworld in the Microverse are fleeing for their lives from the forces of the evil Baron Karza. Enter the Micronauts. Commander Ran, Marie, Bug, Biotron, Acroyer, and Microtron. Rebels with a cause. On the run, they flee to the Macroverse in the StarCraft Endeavor. They're heading Earth. So that's very important to establish them. I mean, they did not stay in the Microverse, right, Billy? They, in fact, had to flee the Microverse as rebels fighting against the evil Baron Karza. Because Karza was all over the place. He controlled most of the planets in the Microverse. And then the only way that the Micronauts would be free to deal, to kind of plan the rebellion further, is to do it Star Wars style, like, you know, escaping in the Millennium Falcon, like Han and his crew. But, you know, they could not escape Baron Karza in any conventional sense in the Microverse. So they, in fact, decided to breach the wall that separates, you know, this cosmic wall that separates the Microverse from the Macroverse, and they entered our universe. So with the effect that they were diminutive in size when they arrived. I mean, issue two, they would, it's the Micronauts basically versus a lawnmower. The lawnmower man. So, you know, Billy, but, you know, I like this whole premise of the Micronauts. Now, I'm going to let you talk on that first. What do you think about, I mean, there's two things I want you to focus on when you think about Micronauts and telling me what you think of it. The concept of Commander Ran being a type of Buck Rogers figure, a man out of time, almost like a Captain America figure, too. And the whole idea of Baron Karza and his body banks, which is directly based off of the toys. I mean, from the toy story that, I mean, the toy mythology that the, you know, people over at MIGO developed, Baron Karza having these body banks, and that allows you as a toy collector to add different body parts to your toys, you know, to flesh them out as cyborgs. What do you think about that concept of Commander Ran and his journey through space, a thousand-year journey in stasis, and also then this thing with Baron Karza and the body banks?
Yeah, so the Baron Karza deal is he basically was able to usurp by getting the people of that world to jump on board with him because he offered them immortality. So that's how he got a lot of the populace to turn on the ruling class there. It's not like the ruling class that was there was treating the people badly or anything like that. It was just he was able to sucker them into his plan by saying, hey, you know, I have these, you know, scientific ways to basically extend your life forever. So, you know, that's pretty appealing to people to not ever die. So that was a neat, I like that. That was definitely different. I don't know of anything that was going on at the time like that at all. And then the whole stasis thing, it reminded me of Aliens, you know, or Aliens when you know, Ripley's asleep for how long and then wakes up. It kind of reminded me of that because you're kind of, like you said, like Cap, like a man out of time. Like you're like, it's going to take you a while to adjust to what's going on and figure out where everything's at.
Yeah. I mean, Commander Ran is a creation of Bill Mantlo based off of the toy action figure from Micronauts called Space Glider. You know, so the whole idea behind Commander Ran is he would eventually, well, he has it in the very first issue, these glider wings that, you know, extend from this pack on his back. And he is a very expert space glider. He can glide, he can fly. He's the flyer of the bunch, right? And then, you know, you have the royal family who are being hunted to extinction in the beginning here by Baron Karza as his troops. And you've got only two of them surviving. And that is the Princess Marie, who will be later known by her nickname or her, well, code name, Marionette. And we'll get into why later. And her brother, Prince Argon. And Argon would eventually, I mean, he would be captured and he would eventually become evil. He would become a character called Force Commander. But, you know, that's down the line. The very first enemy is firmly Baron Karza. Now, Baron Karza, he's very interesting, right, Billy? Because he, a thousand years ago, Homeworld, where arguably only humans were based then, Commander Rand being their foremost space explorer and, well, what do you call it? A micronaut, right? Because he's in the microverse, astronaut, micronaut. Right. He's a space explorer. They only had faster than light travel, you know, so they could, like a hyperdrive, they could travel, but it took them 1,000 years to travel to all the known worlds in the microverse proper. Because Commander Rand wanted to establish diplomatic relations with these alien races in the microverse. And he did that along with his faithful cybernetic companion, Biotron. It was only them. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a journey of 1,000 years. And his scientist parents, Dallin and Sepsis, they were the mastermind behind this journey that Commander Rand took to discover all of the worlds and explore them and you know, discover these alien races. And so when he returned, Billy, after his successful mission, he was in stasis. He was in cryo sleep, and it took him 1,000 years to come back. But during that time, warp drive technology had been developed by Homeworld, and that led to them instantaneously warping to these planets that Commander Rand has discovered and that he has sent the coordinates back to Homeworld for. So that led to the alien races then immigrating and, you know, coming to Homeworld, which made it a much more diverse universe than the one that Commander Rand was used to when he initially left 1,000 years ago. And when he does return, he expected a hero's welcome, but in fact, he was immediately arrested by the forces of Baron Karza and, thrown into the pleasure pits, which are these can you call them gladiatorial execution arenas, right, Billy? That where Baron Karza throw the undesirables. But the important thing is, Billy, actually, that Commander Rand knew Baron Karza from 1,000 years ago. He was the chief scientist, and he's also responsible for the death of Dallin and Sepsis, Commander Rand's famous parents, who have since become deified as gods. 1,000 years later, they're worshipped as gods. So everybody swears by their name, specifically Princess Marie of the royal family of Homeworld and her brother Argon, you know. So Commander Rand, though, is a direct, you know, he's the son of Dallin Sepsis. So they almost sometimes see him as holy, even though he's not. You know, they're just humans who attain the status of gods. So Baron Karza has been alive for 1,000 years through his science of this body bank technology that he controls that ensures immortality. And it's actually horrible if you think about it, Billy, because where do they get the extra body parts for that ensure the mortality, their immortality, from the poorer members of the populace? So
yeah,
it's very disturbing. And then they've also got this technology of grafting, you know, robotic parts onto humans, also creating cyborgs, much like we saw in ROM. So, you know, then we have the entire cast of characters established during this first issue, which I appreciate. You know, I always like that we get to see everybody. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it disturbs me to see people later on. You know, I like to see the whole cast at first, but it's not always feasible to do that. But, you know, my favorite character is definitely the Spartak King or Monarch, a Croyer. I used to call him Acroyer as a kid, but apparently the correct pronunciation is a Croyer. He's this alien warrior from this planet called Spartak, and he is in the same situation as the royal family of Homeworld because his people turned against him in order to benefit from Baron Karza's body bank technology that grants them immortality. And then they turned on their own king and ousted him. So he's a prisoner in the pleasure pits as well, along with his best friend among the Micronauts. And, you know, they're a great buddy team as well. A character called Bug, who's from an insectivorid race. They're called the Insectivorids. He's a master thief, but also he possesses super agility because he's kind of like a grasshopper-human hybrid. Right, Billy? What would you call him? He's got a rocket lance. He's great. And then you've got Princess Marie. She's a great fighter. She was called Marionette because she used to, in order to escape the attentions of Baron Karza's Inquisitors, she pretended to be a marionette controlled by her faithful, retainer, Microtron, who's much like Commander Rand's servant, Biotron. Microtron is a sentient robot. well, half robot, half, you know. Well, they're like the Star Wars droids, right, Billy? They're alive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sort of. They're like C-3PO and R2-D2, kind
of. Yeah, exactly, yeah. So they're, you know, basically that's the whole team. You know, it's Commander Ran, it's Marie, it's a Croyer, and it's Bug, and then it's Microton and Biotron. And then later on there will be some people added to the cast, but nobody significant. And so, you know, my point is that, you know, if we've got everybody set up and we already see what they can do. Bug shows off his super agility when they escape the pleasure pits after they're, you know, menaced by this death tank that's sent in to kill them in the pleasure pits for the, you know, enjoyment of the masses, helmed by Baron Karza, who's dressed in this kick-ass looking black armor, right, Billy? And then you've got a Croyer showing off his super strength, which apparently, I mean, is standard for all Spartak warriors. I mean, if you think about it, their name comes from Spartans, right, Billy? From from the Greek era, the Greek era. So,
yeah.
So Spartans, Spartak, they're known as great warriors. They've got energy swords, much like the you know, lightsabers. But this is more like a blade that's just empowered by some kind of energy that can slice through nearly everything. But his main power is his incredible super strength, which apparently even exceeds that of a normal Spartak warrior. And so these Spartaks are warriors are kind of the shock troops of Baron Karza, because he employs them in this issue to hunt down their king, a Croyer, who's just, I mean, the race is called a Croyers, and he's just called a Croyer. So we never get, you know, that's just his name. He's the same name as the race. So, you know, Baron Karza's got all these forces at his disposal. They're hard-pressed. The only way they can get out of there is to escape in the Endeavor, which is Commander Rand's spaceship, which can travel faster than light. And then they do so, right, Billy? They break through the space wall, reminiscent of DC's, you know, New Gods, the Source Wall. They break through the space wall, which separates the microverse from the macroverse. And that's how they eventually end up on Earth, miniaturized, obviously, the size of the toys. Very appropriately so. So, yeah. Billy, what did you think about this first issue? I mean, we've said it's all over the place. That's true. But there's some good bits.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, like I said, it'll separate itself from anything else it might remind you of very quickly. You know, it's already starting to do that. And then by issue 2, 3, 4, 5, it does take off into its own thing. And it's very complex. There's a lot going on. So it's one of those comics where you have to take your time to read it and really be observant with the artwork and everything to, like, know and understand what's going on. So, you know, it's not, I mean, you could say it was from a toy, so it's for kids and stuff like that, but it's definitely a comic book that, you know, is for adults as well.
Yeah.
For sure. It's not simplified in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it's even more, I would say, complex than the Star Wars comics, because whereas Star Wars, the movie,
oh, yeah,
you know, the first movie, the New Hope, was very complicated in terms of the issues it dealt with. The comics were, I'm not going to say dumbed down, but the comics were that Marvel produced in the beginning were nowhere near as, you know, intricate as the movie. Even though I still love those comics, you know, because, hey, it was Star Wars, right? But here we've got the opposite happening. You've got this toy line meant for kids, but you've got this comic book written with verve and with a large bit of intelligence on Munch's parts, a lot of sci-fi know-how as well. And even though he didn't have a lot of time for character development in this issue, he definitely got the ball rolling with this action sequence. Basically, entire first issue is a chase scene, right, Billy? With a brief rest stop once they're captured and they chill in the pleasure pits awaiting execution. And then they escape and then they're on the run again. So it's this prolonged chase scene. So it kind of it goes at a breakneck pace, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, basically Micronauts, you know, it was a successful comic. I'd say ROM was more successful because, after all, ROM ran for 75 issues and 4 annuals. Micronauts ran for 59 issues, Billy, with 2 annuals. And after 1984, when the initial Volume 1 was canceled, it again had it was reprinted as a 12-issue miniseries, and then it had another series a 4-issue limited series in 1984. And that was co-written again by Bill Mantlow and Chris Claremont, you know, at that point in time. I think the art was by Butch Geis. So, you know, Micronauts, you know, they were very popular. And then I think from 1984 to 86, it ran, there was a second volume of Micronauts called The New Voyages, which ran, you know, for 20 issues. I think Peter B. Gillis, yeah, Peter Gillis wrote that. So, you know, Billy, Micronauts, very successful, probably, arguably, you know, on par with ROM. And that's why we chose to discuss it this time around. Now, Billy, let's get to our favorite bits and bobs here. I'm going to let you start. Three covers. Let's talk about them. Which one did you particular? I mean, just tell me your general impression of all three, and then we pick a favorite.
Well, I think all three are very good. You know, like you said, with ROM, you got Frank Miller and Joseph Rubinstein. And then with the Micronauts one here, you have Dave Cockrum, who is one of our you know, all-time favorites. We both love him quite a bit.
Yeah, he's just, from the X-Men. Oh, love him.
Yeah, he's just totally cool. I don't know that he's ever done anything bad, in my opinion.
Never.
I don't know if I'll ever say a bad word about Dave Cockrum.
About Dave, no, never.
And then the Godzilla one, that's, you know, like we said, right, Trimpy, right? It's pretty cool, too. Like you said, Godzilla is a little not as Godzilla like the movies, but it's still a pretty good cover, too, and it's just zany. Like, that comic is just so crazy and out there. That's a good one, too. You can't go wrong with any of these three covers. All three of them are on par with each other, for sure.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, man, I agree. The covers are great. None of them are bad covers, and we have seen a lot of bad covers during our time, right, as comic readers. Mm-hmm. But these covers are nowhere near those covers. This is definitely, I mean, Godzilla's tearing it up. People are fleeing in terror. You know, he's got his fire breath on full display, and it's a great logo effect that they pick, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, taken obviously inspired by the movie logo of Godzilla, but they add their own Marvel flair to it. And then, you know, you can see it's a dynamic cover because there's motion, you know, as penciled by Trimpy. I'm going to go with my favorite, though, is that iconic Frank Miller cover for ROM. You know, Billy, that thing has been in my mind for ages and ages. I love that cover. I love the very first page where ROM exits his asteroid. And the cover and that image by Sal Buscema on the second page go hand in hand for me. But this cover is very reminiscent. I mean, it's appropriate if you think the town in Clairton that he arrived in, which is what the cover is based off of. It's ROM's arrival. It fits in nicely with the story, which is called Arrival, and also with every single sci-fi, you know, horror movie from the 1950s where this alien monster or robot shows up. And even the marquee at the theater, right, Billy, in the comics sported a monster movie that they were displaying, The Thing from Outer Space, right? And even some people, when ROM appeared on the street, they were awed, but they didn't initially run away because they thought it was a promotional stunt for the movie playing in the cinema, right? Some of them. You know, it's a great cover. It meshes nicely with what happens in the comic, and you've got this shining, twinkling effect that Miller puts on ROM's armor, and you've got his neutralizer in hand. You've got ROM's, you know, badass looking fists. Basically, he's got a thumb, and then it looks like metal mittens, right, Billy, that he's wearing. He doesn't have any fingers. He just has a thumb and then a glove-like, you know, a single finger on the main base of his hand, right? But I've always loved those because when he punches someone, it looks badass.
Yeah.
So my favorite cover. What about you, Billy?
Yeah, I mean, if I had to pick one, I would definitely go with ROM as well. But yeah, I can, like I said, the Micronauts, that one's super cool too. Oof. That would probably be my second favorite just because of Cockrum's the man.
Dave Cockrum, I mean, this cover is great. I love Cockrum. You know how I feel. It's just in my mind, When I think about great covers, I think about ROM. This one is good, you know, the concept, you know, being Baron Karzai in the background, the Micronauts, you know, running in the foreground, and Commander Rand's got his blaster, he's got a massively muscular chest. I mean, Commander Rand is very much like a classic space hero, you know, Billy, if you think about folks like Buck Rogers, You know, he's also like Captain America, like we said, a man out of time. But he's more like a space hero, like Flash Gordon. He's got his signature blaster, much like Adam Strange over at DC. And he's a very heroic type figure. He's a great leader, one of the better leaders in comics. But ultimately, he is a knockoff of, you know, what some people who came before. Marie, Bug, and a Croyer, though, are, for me, very original creations. Now, obviously, they stem from the toy line. Well, Doug Munch and Michael Golden definitely tweaked a lot of the characters, you know. But they are, for me, very original, you know, looking, you know, characters. And very, you know, space-inspired characters still, so they're alien. But they're, I haven't seen many aliens like this, you know. And Princess Marie is beautiful, you know. And she always has these I don't know if it's makeup effects or what is it around her eyes. But I love it. I love her color scheme, her costume, everything. So
Cockrum draws her very sexy. The only nitpick I would have about the cover is, you know, the main character right there in the middle, for some reason, has a... shadow over his crotch. So I don't know if he forgot to zip up his pants after he was at the bathroom or what, but
I thought you were gonna mention a Croyer's blaster nipples.
His nipples. Yeah. I looked at that and I thought, what in the world? I thought, nope, don't even ask. I'm not even gonna say it.
No, but it's we're just being funny now, you know, it's nitpicking. But, you know, I always love the fact that the Micronauts had a very distinctive, title card or logo style to their name, right, Billy? They came from inner space, and then they wrote it, the Micronauts, in this very interesting font. And then, you know, their corner box art, most of the time featured Baron Karza in his armor. So I love that. I loved it. And a great cover, great series. We'll get to some pretty kick-ass covers down the line. But yeah, Cockrum's the man. And Al Milgram also had a hand in the cover. So Billy, a fantastic first episode. I enjoyed it talking to you about, you know, these three comics. We do have to get to our favorite bits, though. I'm going to go ahead and say right off the bat now, Rom's my favorite of these three, but more for nostalgic reasons. But, you know, I love the dialogue in the Godzilla comic, especially the dialogue of Dum-Dum Dugan. You know, I think, you know, Munch wrote his dialogue brilliantly. You know, I've got a couple of examples here. You know, when Dum-Dum first shows up and he kind of berates the S.H.I.E.L.D. guys for losing. he's got the squadron of flyers called Mosquitoes, and I mean, that's the name, and then they get swatted like mosquitoes and he's upset. I mean, what you they've the mosquito kind of squadron, you know. And then, you know, he laments the fact that his disc-like flying aircraft has been, you know, destroyed. So he says, so much for that. Looks like it's time for old Dum-Dum to bail out of the jaws of death, because I never could stand bad breath. And then he literally jumps out of Godzilla's jaws. And then, you know, he's got a couple of lines. Yeah, okay, he's with Jimmy Woo. We need to mention Jimmy Woo as his second in command for S.H.I.E.L.D., because Jimmy Woo recently showed up in the Marvel MCU on WandaVision. You know, Billy, although there he wasn't working for S.H.I.E.L.D., he was working for the FBI. But still, Jimmy Woo, great character. I've always liked him as one of the S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, mainstays, you know, along with guys like, let's say, Clay Quatermain, even though sometimes he was working for Gamma Base. You know, there's some S.H.I.E.L.D. agents that just stand out to you, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, Billy, you've got Dum-Dum saying, all right, you yard birds. He's very much like Ben Grimm the Thing sometimes. Here he comes. Closer, closer, now. You know, and then he says, I don't believe it. The big gun was the best piece of weaponry. And the great big lug turned it into shrapnel. You know, he's very much speaking in a Thing kind of a register. You know, and I like that. I really dig it. And he's always sporting this little bowler hat. Like, what the hell? Even though he's dressed in this S.H.I.E.L.D. sci-fi regalia. He's got his little bowler hat, his huge red mustache, and his cigar. So, yeah, they love that about Godzilla. And then specifically what I liked about the Micronauts is this world building that Bill Mantlo seemed to fit in to a very short amount of time. You got this whole world that's been fleshed out by Mantlo and by Michael Golden. So that's what I like. Billy, any highlights for you?
Yeah, so for me, it's definitely all about Rom, just like it is for you. For me, it's not nostalgia, really, necessarily. I just think it was the best written and the best artwork. Like, top to bottom, that was the best issue out of the three. Like, to me, it's not even close. And I love Rom's dialogue, where, you know, you were saying about the National Guard trying to stop him, and the guns don't do anything, and he throws their tank, and then one of the soldiers says, "Shells have no effect on him, but what about flame?" Rom turns his head a little bit and goes, "I have flown near the stars, humans. Your pale, pitiful fire cannot harm me."
Oh.
He really has some good insults for a robot. And then, like you said, the one soldier, who's actually a wraith, pulls out this crazy, you know, energy blaster. And one of the human soldiers says, "Hey, I've never seen a gun like that before. Where did you..." And the wraith, "Shut up." He fires it at Rom, and it actually does hurt Rom, you know, because it's a weapon from, you know, space. And then he just totally goes nuts on that wraith and just annihilates him and then sends him to limbo. And it's just funny. Yeah, some of the – I love the dialogue in that one.
You probably have the soldiers and the rest of the human cast regretting the fact that Rom pulled out his universal translator and learned our language, because now he's employing the language to devastating effect, even more so than his neutralizer.
Me, Godzilla was so crazy. I really liked Godzilla. Like, my favorite bit in Godzilla was when he ripped up part of the oil pipeline and started swinging it around, like, almost like it was just, you know, a lasso. That was kind of funny. I like that bit. That was funny.
Oh, that was amazing, man. I love that bit, too. What about Micronauts?
Yeah, Micronauts for me, I did enjoy quite a bit. You know, Michael Golden, he, artwork-wise, He was really on point here. You know, it didn't matter what the scenario was, whether they were in those, you know, the pits fighting, like you said, or it was just dialogue scenes. He was really super on point with his artwork in this. You know, it could be a close-up on a face. It could be an action scene. Like, it was all about his artwork in that issue for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Michael Golden, one of our favorites, right, Billy? He did some great Doctor Strange over the years, and Doctor Strange being one of our favorite characters. But he's almost transcended the realm of comics into, you know, general illustration. And, of course, he did Alric, which Michael Moorcock's famous character Alric for the Marvel graphic novel and for other, you know, storylines. And I'm a big fan of that. So, yeah, Michael Golden, one of our favorite Bronze Age artists. And even artists in general, right? I would put him high up there on my list of favorites.
Oh, yeah.
So, Billy, man, successful first episode of, at least in my mind, of the House of Licensed Ideas, presented by Into the Weird. We're going to leave our listeners with where they can find us on Twitter if they don't already know. Of course, we're at sinkintotheweird.com on the web. If you want to check out additional images related to this Patreon episode, I will be posting them on the House of Licensed Ideas post for episode one. And then please follow us on Twitter. I'm at Dark Longbox. Our main account is at Into Weird on Twitter. And then Billy, you're at Billy_Delicious. And then, you know, we want to leave our listeners with a message: stay weird, stay cool, read weird comics, because weird is great and it makes for some awesome storytelling. We love you all. Thanks for subscribing to our Patreon. And I hope you enjoyed this episode, listeners. And we'll be back with another one featuring the second issues of these three titles in a month's time. So I hope you'll return for that.